Being an artist on the Central Coast is anything but easy, but two artists married to each other, working in the same format, is even more challenging. Stay tuned to meet two extraordinary individuals that have mastered the melding of marriage and sculpture.
Good afternoon. I'm Krista Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. Co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, we re-air a program originally created in 2002. This rebroadcast is our tribute to Pozzo Coricelli. Artist, composer, musician, teacher, husband, father, and friend to many on the Central Coast and around the world. He died earlier this summer, and his absence will be felt for decades to come. This is the first of a two-part program. Pozzo may be on mic less, but catch the beauty of his phrases as he defines what is important to him. Born in the Republic of Georgia, his life was molded by tragedy and love. His father's last words were, "At the end of each day, ask yourself if you have done enough." In the eyes of those who knew and loved him, the answer is a resounding yes. We can only hope that his own take was as affirming, for his daily gifts were as rock solid as the marble and granite that he carved, and as harmonic as the music that he played.
We are fortunate today to be visiting with Margaret and Pozzo Coricelli at their art studios in Morro Bay. Join Krista and me as we visit with these two sculptors, their children, Leah and Elena, and their pets, the dog being the most vocal.
Always where to begin. Margaret, your sculpture career started when?
Well, I've considered myself a professional sculptor for maybe 10 years now, but of course I've been making sculpture maybe 20, 25 years. It happened gradually. I think for a long time I fought the idea of calling myself a so-called professional and then just realized that, okay, it's an obsession. I think I'm going to just keep going with this.
Did you fight the idea of calling yourself an artist or calling yourself a professional?
A little bit of both. I don't know, somehow just being an artist seemed, I don't know, too much for me. I thought, oh, I can never quite fit that, or maybe I had some idea of a mold, and then all of a sudden I realized that that's what I'm doing anyway, and I think it was just partly getting used to the terminology.
I think that that's an interesting kind of place of the nomenclature of why we're not quite willing to take on the term artist sometimes. I know that I feel some of that, and I'm not quite sure if it has something to do with our sense of, does it seem too pompous to say that? What do you think it is?
I think partly a sense of good humility, of just knowing that there's so many fantastic people in the world that are doing so much. And then I think it's also a part of what people project onto you when you say you're an artist. I have so many people that as soon as I tell them that, they tell me how they can't draw. And I think, you know, I don't say to my dentist, I can't clean teeth. And but there is always that dynamic that certainly is set up. And also just really, I think it takes a tremendous commitment to being an artist. That's one of the things that I tell my students is that it's not something you necessarily choose to do. It chooses you. And in some ways, there's a sense of healthy resistance to that process that shows that you're ready to take that step and to follow that path, because it is a path.
In terms of choosing you, do you remember as a child or was it an adult? When did it choose you?
I have four siblings, and three of my older siblings were interested in art, so it was something that I grew up with. And my grandfather was an artist. He was a magician and an illustrator. He was one of the first that was both, and so he's known for illustrating magic. And then, of course, my parents weren't artists. I've heard it often skips generations, so they actually decided that it was important to be stable and earn a living and that kind of thing. But art was always a part of our home. You know, we had actual paintings in our house rather than just posters. And you know, when we traveled, we would visit historical sites and museums. And so I think I've always grown up with a love of art.
But so when did it start for you?
Well, I really don't remember when it started. I'm kind of a tumbleweed of the world, and every time I change the places, I picked up something. I know musically I started at home. My mom was a pianist, and both of them would sing together with me at the dinner table every day. And then I picked up there, but really pursued music very seriously. And I got motivated when I was a teenager. My friends would take me to a movie. The movie was a really popular thing. And they wanted to remember the tune they heard in the movie, and I was the only one who would go home and play on the piano for them. So they would pay my way in and all that. It was very wonderful. And that really got me going. And then art, actually. When I came to this country, I had a scholarship at conservatory, so I was going to go back to Europe. But I was persuaded of my teacher to stay. I had to find a job. There was a furniture factory, and they were advertising for color mixing. The boss called me, and there were ladies sitting in his office and having a magazine in front of them with beautiful color furniture. He said, "Can you do this color?" And I said, "I don't know." So luckily, I had a wonderful old fellow, Mexican fellow, who was lacquer sprayer and then finisher, and he helped me to develop a certain color. I guess I was pretty good at mixing the colors, and he hired me, and I was making so much money and didn't know where to save it those days, and $3 an hour was a lot of money. Then I started university, and that money, I was keeping money in where I kept my underwear, you know. I didn't know English was coming along very well, and I had to buy the car to travel. And I went with this friend of mine to the Gordon Chevrolet on Hollywood Boulevard, and we liked the car and said, "Well, we'll pay for it," and we started counting money. They turned white and they ran out and called all the banks where anybody was robbed. Well, we paid it out. They lined up and waved at us.
That's a great visual in itself.
So, speaking of artists, everybody's artist. You have to define what I mean by artist and what I mean by creative process. You know, I kind of try to get out what's in me and capture the beauty. So, you have to define that. What do you mean by artist?
And a
professional, and Tawada, what's a professional artist?
We're standing here in your sculpture studio, surrounded by many pieces of marble that you are working on creating some different pieces.
Yes.
Can you talk about some of these? How did that discipline get started?
I met a country fellow. There are not many Georgians in this country. There may be 140 of us, if that many. You may touch me. He inspired me for the stone, and I took it up right away. He said every time you hit the chisel hammer and smell the stone. And I love that smell. The sulfur smell comes out of the marble. Every time I hit the hammer, there's a chip falls off, and the new world opens up, you know. And that kind of becomes a fascination. It cannot stop. So go on and on. I guess if you can define an artist, everybody has the quality. It has to be found which way and what. Where to find the truth and the beauty.
Are you working the stone most frequently with mallet and chisel?
Primarily, I don't like the power tools. My students love it. They said to me, "Oh, look, if Michelangelo would have had this diamond saw, he would have used it." And I have to agree. He would have probably. I don't know. I don't know. There's a chisel mark which shows that its hand has been on there.
You've alluded already to your love of just the process, the smell and the visual
and touch.
Exposure and the touch. Is there even a disappointment when a piece is finished in that sense?
Very much so. I finished my self-portrait over there. It's a Sisyphus carrying the stone. Sisyphus complex, you know. We get up and carry the stone up and go to sleep and come down and carry it again. And that was sold And I was so attached to it that he couldn't pick it up. It was too heavy. They moved to the Russian River somewhere. I was here for 3 years, and Leah asked me once, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when you die? I said, well, there's me right over there. I said, I'll put it in the garden, and you come and talk to me once in a while. So I called these people, and I said, would you please come select some other piece? And luckily, they were very understanding, and they chose the giant apple over there. So I'm going to keep that.
So do you feel that your sculptures are actually parts of you, that they're processed and that you live with them for such a period of time that they actually become part of you?
Very, 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 very much. It's inseparable sometimes. But you cannot keep them all.
No.
Where do you acquire the marble that you're...
I buy them periodically. Some of them were just given to me practically as old Carrara, what you see here. And in old cemeteries, I go around and they would sell to me if there was some. There was a Scottish guy, bless his soul, passed away, and they misspelled his name, and it was rejected by the owners. And a gorgeous piece, and he sold it to me reasonably. So I'm praying that somebody would misspell some more names.
Do you find anything, not necessarily marble, but other carvable stone in this area?
I love granite. In this area, no, you have to go to Fresno and San Diego. Yeah,
Fresno is closer than Italy, so I guess I'm sort of including it as this area.
It's good marble. There's some areas in here, San Diego, too, the lower part of the Sierras. Black marble, it's wonderful. I love that. In fact, every marble I made, it's gone. I just love it. Yeah, it's there's something about marble. You have to be careful with silicon and breathing and all that. But this you can digest. It's
The whiter the marble is, the safer it is.
Much. Michelangelo lived old age and didn't have a mask.
Didn't have a lot of things.
Hello, a little brandy and anchovy and wine.
So you're working on a collection of pieces here that you're trying to get together to be able to put a show together?
It takes me a lot longer. I have a baby to raise, and I became a house husband, too, so it's slower. But I have three very capable apprentices. They're doing exactly what I'm told to do.
How does that work in terms of, for you emotionally or whatever, to have to direct somebody else to creating what's in your head?
That's a good question. They have to understand, they have to love you in first place, and if they hate you, they're going to do something wrong.
Sabotage the work.
Human communication is the most important. I try to teach the humanities, that's what I used to do. Yeah, sometimes they dance away a little bit, and I said, you're getting a little apprenticephobia or something, and they have to remember that's my piece, it's not yours. And they slow down immediately because they sometimes take off in a little different direction than I want.
Are they working from drawings that you've done or from
sometimes
models?
Drawing, and I just draw right in the stone, but I'm here when they do. I'm right here, make my rounds, so to say.
Are you out here almost every day?
No, I wish I could. No, I have quite a few music students, a young orchestra I'm trying to raise, and pianists. But sometimes I have this big light here, and if everybody's asleep, I come out and then do a little Indian dance around them, a night dance or some sort.
When you get a stone, do you have a preconceived notion as to what the sculpture is going to look like when you get the stone, and do you hunt for the stone in that way, or does the stone in a way tell you what the sculpture is going to end up being?
Yeah, that's a very organic question. Mm-hmm. I think I do look at the shape of the stone, like that stone, for instance, over there. It's kind of a nice cave inside, mm-hmm. and immediately triggered something. On this kind of shape, to kind of marry them together, you know, it's very affectionately, diversity, black and white. Oh, they tell you. There's definitely a conversation, unexplainable conversation between you and the stone, more than painting. I used to paint a little bit, but much more. I haven't touched the brush since I touched this chisel.
You are listening to Ears on Art with today's guests, Bozzo and Margaret Coroscelli. We return as Bozzo continues to describe his work with stone.
I learned first year with Mr. Papashvili. He apprenticed me just to go and carry the stones for him and find the right kind of stone. He wouldn't let me touch the chisel. Second year, yeah, a little bit there, a little bit there. But what I learned first year, I use more than the chisel, in a way, what to look for and what type of a stone.
Is part of that also learning how to know when a piece of marble or a piece of stone is full of flaws and stuff? Is that part of
that's right.
What
he
your
taught
expertise
me to do that.
Developed to? And
yes.
What are some of the tricks to that? How can you tell?
Here the fairly heavy, hefty hammer, and he would say, you have good eyes now. He was much older. Would you look at that crack? And I'm going to hit that devil out of stone with my hammer if something moves there. And I would look at it very close, sometimes too close, and he would really whack that stone. And sometimes someone would say, yeah, George, it moved there. I said, throw it away. Yeah, it's all kinds of tricks there. Yeah.
So you and Margaret met up when? How long have you been together as artists as well as a family?
Maybe she should talk
okay.
Now.
Yeah, we met about 20 years ago, and I had just moved to the area, and a friend of mine said, oh, you have to meet this sculptor, because he knew I was doing sculpture. And we met, and I don't know, we just went from there. And there aren't very many sculptors. It's a physically demanding profession, not only just to make the work, but even just to show the work, to, you know, lift it, put it in a van, take it to places, set it up. And so you just have to be a little crazy to do it. And we were both equally crazy.
Did you start out doing some stonework with that initial meeting with Bozzo, or were you always working with other materials?
I had worked with other materials primarily. Steel has always been my first love. I love working in metal, and also wood carving, those two things. And I had done a little bit of alabaster, but I wanted to learn how to carve marble and granite. The direct carving. And so I started working with Bozzo. And then after, I don't know, maybe a year or two, I found I loved the carving process, but I couldn't express what I wanted to express in stone. I like to work
because?
I like to work in forms that are long and linear, and everything in stone, just by nature of the material, is compact and solid. My much more Giacometti kind of person, you know, and he's known for doing his very tall, thin figures. So I, you know, even now I'll still love to come out and help him polish a stone or something like that. That's our little 1.5-year-old you hear on my back here. I ran out of crackers, sorry.
For all the mother.
But it's just not my medium to say what I want to say.
I think that's a very interesting point of the fact that the material in so many ways does dictate the type of form that comes out on the other end. And I often try to make sure that students get exposed to enough different processes so that maybe they find that happy match, because if you're struggling along trying to hit a chisel all your life and nobody showed you about clay, you know, maybe
exactly.
You didn't get to become who you were going to become. So when did you get exposed to metal? How did that happen?
I was in high school and I had a teacher that worked in metal as his own work. And he actually even had a bronze casting facility in the high school, which was very rare.
Oh.
I know. And so I started working primarily in sculpture in high school. Before that, I had always wanted to be an artist, but I was more interested in drawing and painting. And as soon as I found sculpture, I shouldn't say that, I was immediately drawn to it. Again, like we talked about, it took me a long time to think, oh, this is what I can really do for a profession and for my livelihood.
So in the bronze casting, were you creating in wax, or were you working in metal and making metal pieces?
In the high school, he was doing styrofoam. and we were doing the sand investment where we were just directly burning out the styrofoam. So it was very quick and relatively easy. You know, looking back, they were fairly blobby. But, you know, that's what grinders are for.
No Giacometti's here.
No Giacometti's there. No. And but again, it's being exposed to the process. And there's something about even just witnessing a bronze pour that's so exciting. It's, you know, there's something just elemental there. It's like seeing the earth created when you see that molten bronze.
And you're at Aquesta now, and they have a...
Very exciting. I've just been hired to teach full-time. I've been teaching part-time out there for about 10 years, and I'm just thrilled that I'll be able to take over the program there. It's a wonderful program that, you know, has been built up over the last 20, 30 years, and now I just can't wait to continue with it and put my own mark on it and see where it goes.
Will you be doing part of the foundry or in charge of that, or will you be taking off and developing the whole new metal cutting, or both?
Both. I'll be in charge of the foundry, and I'll be teaching foundry, and then I'll also teach welding. I've always been doing that, and figure sculpture, woodworking. I'd like to start doing some things with found elements with the students.
I think that probably my first exposure to your work was with a sculpture show that was at the San Luis Obispo Art Center that involved several pieces that featured the use of the dog as your basic symbol or format. I was totally captivated by those pieces. I'm fortunate enough to own one several years later that's considerably smaller than those. In fact, there were quite a few wood pieces, as I remember, in that show. They were whimsical, they were serious, they were just sort of everything. Obviously metaphorical, and where did all that come from? Are you a real dog lover? Are they part of your everyday existence?
Well, I do love dogs, but I also found that it was just a symbol I was completely drawn to. And it, one thing, it had so many dimensions, you know, in the sense of being a companion, a guide, being playful, being serious, all of that. And I just found I could, you know, if I had an idea, that the symbol of the dog was always there, I could adapt it somehow. For me, it became a symbol of the life spirit. And a lot of my work, I come from a religious family, but to what I would call, I know religions can't truly be opposite, but if religions could, my mother and father practiced opposite religions. And one a Western religion, one a Eastern religion. And so, you know, I kind of grew up with some mostly healthy, but sometimes not so healthy skepticism of religion, but found my spiritual outlet in my art. And so these, you know, the work that I did with the dogs, it was basically a symbol for the life spirit and for the, you know, what is beyond our human physical body. And in a lot of cultures, the dog is a symbol of being able to go from the physical to the spiritual. For me, it captured that. I like it because it can also be a rawness about, you know, there's a sense of they're ferocious and yet they're also tame and they're domestic.
Where is the work now? You indicated to me earlier that the dogs were sort of done and you're on to other things?
They are. The last show that I did with the dogs involved, I made, oh, I think 300 very tall, thin canines out of steel, and it was an installation piece that filled the room. And at that point, they were only like an inch, sometimes an inch and a half, 3 inches thick at the most, and it was almost like that, you know, I was dealing with images of transcendence, and they transcended. That was it. And just partly in my own life, I just became more interested in the issue of being embodied and started working with the image of the wheelbarrow. And again, I just tend to be obsessive about images, and so I've been working with that image for about the last 5 years. And the wheelbarrow to me was the sense of work, obviously, and then also the sense of the wheel being a symbol of, oh, the universe, life, death, rebirth, destruction, and that's just taken me all different areas. I also find that I'm in a place where I'm experimenting with a lot of different images now. I've gone back to working figuratively, and I don't exactly know what my next obsession is going to be. I'm still working on some wheelbarrows, but I can tell they're changing again, and I don't know where it'll go.
One of the interesting things about the work from both of you is that at least with the stone, Bozzo, your process is very much a subtractive one. You start with this block and you chisel down and find that beautiful form within the stone. And you can start, Margaret, with an empty tabletop and sheets of metal or rebar or whatever and start building and cutting? I mean, do you find as you talk to each other that you're conscious of that different way of thinking?
Very much so, and I think we're good critics of each other's work because we work so differently. I know that each of us will get to a certain point in a work and we'll call the other one over and say, what do you think? Where is it going? But the advantage to my work is that I can always cut something off, weld it back on. You know, it's very flexible, whereas a stone, you break the stone in half.
She's lucky.
She's lucky?
Yeah, she can have to.
Uh-huh. You can put it back once it's cut off, but in your case, it's gone.
It's gone.
Do you find sometimes, Bozo, that watching the potential of a different kind of speed that Margaret can... I mean, that she can physically get a piece of work done perhaps faster than you can. Is that something that you're sometimes envious of, or do you find that the process is so engaging for you that that isn't something you really think
well,
of?
Yeah. I have a substitute for that. I have a music. I can go and play Bach and piano, and then it's there, ready to go and enjoy. So that's where the music and art is married quite nicely.
You're holding your daughter Leah here. Leah, do you create paintings and drawings and art?
Yeah.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things?
Like some interesting butterflies and hearts and designs.
Do you play music too?
I play piano and violin.
Oh. This is called the multi-talented family. And how old are you?
Six.
What were you doing at six?
I don't think I can remember that far back.
Margaret, do you have a music background too?
I don't, not at all. I'm a great appreciator of music. And when I first met Bozo, I thought, oh, I'd love to have him teach me how to play an instrument. But I just find that, you know, art is, you can give it 100%. You can never do enough.
Well, Bozo and Margaret, I can't tell you how what a pleasure it's been to be here and see this wonderful group of facilities and to be able to talk with you and learn more about what it is that inspires you. And thank you very much, both of you, Bozo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks once again to Bozo and Margaret Coroscelli. Next week, we'll continue our conversation with them and add a few more thoughts about what it is to be an artist. Before we go, Stephen and I want to remind you that in December, we conduct our annual storytelling programs. The theme this year is The Gift is Immaterial. Your story is to be no more than 3 minutes long. You write them, come to KCBX, record them, and what we hear are unique stories that every year seem to help us feel more connected. If you're interested, contact us via the KCBX website under Ears on Art. Again, we'll be back next week with part two of Bozo and Margaret. You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced here at the studios of KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. This is Chrissy Hewitt. On behalf of Stephen DeLuque, thanks for listening.